Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Military Culture, an introduction for community healthcare providers, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Elspeth C. Ritchie, MD, MPH, Richard H. Weisler, MD, and Stephen J. Koza, MD. Dr. Ritchie is a Chief Clinical Officer, Department of Mental Health, District of Columbia, Washington, D.C., Professor, Department of Psychiatry, Uniformed Services, University of the Health Sciences, Bethesda, Maryland. Dr. Ritchie has disclosed no relevant financial relationships. Dr. Ritchie does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Ritchie does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Weisler is an adjunct professor of psychiatry, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Medicine, adjunct associate professor of psychiatry, Duke University School of Medicine, Durham, North Carolina. Dr. Weisler has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He received grants for clinical research from Abbott Laboratories, AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, BioVail Corporation, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Burroughs Wellcome Fund, Centerx Biopharma, Cephalon, Comentis, Dynapon Sumitomo Pharma America, Eisai, Eli Lilly and Company, Forest Laboratories, GlaxoSmithKline, Janssen Pharmaceutical Products, Johnson & Johnson Pharmaceutical Research and Development, Lundbeck Research USA, Medicinova, Merck & Company, National Institute of Mental Health, NeuroChem, New River Pharmaceuticals, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, Organon Pharmaceuticals USA, Ortho McNeil Janssen Pharmaceuticals, Pfizer, Pharmacia, Repligen Corporation, Seagis Pharmaceuticals, Sandoz, Sanofi Aventis, Sanofi Synthelabo, Schwaba Ingenix, Sepracor, Shire, Synovion Pharmaceuticals, Synaptic Pharmaceutical Corporation, Takeda Pharmaceuticals North America, Transcept Pharmaceuticals, TransTech Pharma, UCB Pharma, Vela Pharmaceuticals, and Wyeth Pharmaceuticals. He served as an advisor or consultant for Abbott Laboratories, AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, BioVail Corporation, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Ciba Geigy, Cephalon, GlaxoSmithKline, Eli Lilly and Company, Johnson & Johnson Pharmaceutical Research and Development, Organon Pharmaceuticals USA, Otsuka America Pharmaceutical, Pfizer, Pharmacia, Sanofi Aventis, Sanofi Synthelabo, Shire, Solvay Pharmaceuticals, Synovion Pharmaceuticals, Transcept Pharmaceuticals, TransTech Pharma, Validus Pharmaceuticals, and Wyeth Pharmaceuticals. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Abbott Laboratories, AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, BioVail Corporation, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Burroughs Wellcome Fund, Cephalon, Ciba Geigy, Eli Lilly and Company, Forest Laboratories, GlaxoSmithKline, Janssen Pharmaceutical Products, Johnson & Johnson Pharmaceutical Research and Development, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, Organon Pharmaceuticals USA, Pfizer, Sanofi Aventis, Sanofi Synthelabo, Shire, Solvay Pharmaceuticals, Synovion Pharmaceuticals, Validus Pharmaceuticals, and Wyeth Pharmaceuticals. He owns stock, stock options, or bonds from Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Cortex Pharmaceuticals, Merck & Company, and Pfizer. Dr. Weisler does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Weisler does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Koza is a professor, Department of Psychiatry, Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences, Bethesda, Maryland. Dr. Koza has disclosed no relevant financial relationships. Dr. Koza does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Koza does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The goal of this activity is to introduce aspects of military experience and identify questions that may help inform culturally competent discussions about health concerns related to military service for service members and/or their families. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
I want to welcome you back to part of a Medscape series of CME programs to improve the care, we hope, of military family members and even some military veterans themselves in the community. And this talk is going to be on military culture and introduction for community health care providers. I'm Rick Weisler. I'm a psychiatrist in private practice and also an adjunct professor of psychiatry at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and adjunct associate professor at Duke University. And today I'm joined by two distinguished colleagues, and I want to welcome both of you. And Cam Ritchie, as you will learn, has a lot of experience. She had 25 years as a colonel in the Army. She's currently chief clinical officer for the Office of Mental Health District of Columbia after retiring last fall. In addition to that, she is a professor at the Uniformed Services University School of Medicine and Psychiatry Department. And Steve Koza, I want to welcome you as well. Steve also was a 25-year veteran of the Army and retired as a colonel, and he's a professor of psychiatry at Uniformed Services University School of Medicine in Bethesda as well. So why don't we go ahead and get started? And we have a lot of good learning objectives, we hope, and we want to try to help you identify aspects of military culture that may influence the presentation of mental health conditions for people that you might see. And we'll talk in a minute about just the sheer number of people in the community that you may be treating or their family members that may be involved. We'll also propose some screening strategies, including maybe appropriate language that could be useful for primary care or mental health providers treating military personnel and their families. And we'll also look at distinguishing aspects of military identity that are distinct, perhaps based on service branch, duty status, and so on, that could be important. Now, keep in mind the most important thing, I think, is that you're a caring provider who's interested, and you can always ask, and we'll talk about how you do that as well. So why don't we go ahead and start, Steve, if you would, and just talk a little bit about our military community currently.
Sure. Well, you know, sometimes we think of the military as solely the service members, but when you look at the actual numbers, military service members are outnumbered by dependents that include spouses, that include children, and potentially other dependent members of the family. That's not even including extended family members. And so as we think about the military community, it's important for healthcare providers to be remembering that just like the American population, military communities are broad, they're diverse, they're generally young families. About 44% of active duty service members have children, and of those, two-thirds of their children are under the age of 11, and 40% are under the age of 5. So they live in military installations around the country, but they also live in other areas. If they're in the reserve or the guard, they may live in civilian communities, they may just be dispersed in rural areas, maybe close or not close to military installations. And from that standpoint, may or may not be recognized as being military. Our reserve and guard become activated and what we call suddenly military. So when the activation occurs, the family serves more in a military status, but between those activations, they may have civilian jobs and be going about their business in civilian communities just like any other American would be.
Right. And Steve, I'd like to remind the audience that 15% of the military is female, mm-hmm. So we tend to think of the stereotype of the male service member and the female spouse, but in many cases, it's the wife and the mother that's going off to war.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah, I think importantly, this is a group to get in the service, you have to be very healthy. for the most part, and the family members get good care, nurturing, good education. So it's largely a pretty healthy group, isn't it, I think?
It's a very healthy group, and that's for a number of different reasons. And they have certain advantages being in the military. They have homes, they have salaries, they have health care, and there are also challenges related to the military that certainly we'll talk about, related to deployment, related to transitions and moves, all of which is part of the military lifestyle and the military culture.
And there's a lot of resiliency in the military population, I think.
Yes. It's very resilient, but it's also very highly exposed. Mm-hmm. And of course, we do need to distinguish, and we'll talk more about this, but there's the active duty who do all have housing, by and large, and health care. But then there's a reservist who may or may not be getting military benefits and military health care, and in some cases are struggling with employment and with housing when they're not on active duty. So we've got to take into account the broad spectrum of the military that we've got.
And it can be challenging if you've been on, a reservist suddenly called up for duty to find employment again when you come back and then leave, too.
Unfortunately, sure. Yes.
And when we add the veterans into the mix, then we're really talking about, because we have a tendency to think about the military as a kind of a stagnant group. It's a quite fluid organization, so people are constantly coming in. They vary in terms of the amount of time that they stay in the military. They exit, and there are many ex-military veterans who've had a variety of different experiences living in communities around the country.
So if you were listening to the program, what ballpark percentage would you say of the population are active duty military at any one time? Be around 1% or so, or less, or?
What percent of the national population
would be active duty?
We usually use the term about 1%.
1%. And if you look at veterans, like Steve was talking about, that number would obviously be much higher. How high does that get?
It would be. And one of the things I think I'd like to do is, there's a lot of confusion about the word veteran. Mm-hmm. So let's define it here a little bit. We're going to have the military service member being those who are on active duty, and the veteran being somebody who's transitioned off of active duty. Where it gets really confusing is the National Guard and Reserve, who are coming on and off of active duty status. And with that transition, they have changes in their health benefits, whether they can get TRICARE, which is a purchase care system, whether they're eligible for the VA, and at what point. So we don't have time to sort it all out here, but just be aware that there's many different statuses that people are coming on and off active duty.
Well, let's also talk, if we can, Cam, and I think the important thing for the audience is realize, as she mentioned, there are different branches of the service, and we have different officers. So why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, we have the Army, which traditionally, soldiers, we think of ourselves often as one that are boots on the ground.
And you're not biased at all in this, being an Army officer for 25 years.
I'm biased because I think all branches of the military are great, and certainly I've been in many, many situations where I've relied on the Marines to protect our compound or the Air Force to fly us there.
But Rick, I think that's a good point, because there is a lot of friendly rivalry between the services. It's part of the culture.
Absolutely.
There's an enjoyment of both working together to get the job done, and also a certain level of competition that gets played out in a number of different ways, and that's part of the culture of the military.
Yeah.
And in addition, within, for example, in the Navy, you have people who drive boats, only their ships. You have people who manage submarines. You have pilots. You have CBs who build things. So there's lots and lots of different types of jobs within all these organizations. The Air Force obviously flies planes, but they have a great deal of other jobs that are related to the Air Force. The Marines, by and large, are boots on the ground also, and they're the expeditionary force. They actually are supported by Navy physicians, although in this joint environment, joint is all the services, we all take care of each other. Mm-hmm. And then you have the Coast Guard, who do an incredible incredible amount of dangerous work that are out patrolling our waterways, but technically belong to Homeland Security, although in time of war they are part of our uniform branches.
So what's important for the audience to remember is that when a service member comes to them, they are bringing with them a rich history mm-hmm. and potentially a very diverse occupational background. So they may be what we refer to as enlisted status, which is usually some of the junior statuses of the military, all the way up to senior enlisted, that include those who've been in the military for 20 or 30 years and really run much of the military in terms of what they do. And then we have our officer ranks.
So for the enlisted, you come in as a private, usually, and you work your way up to various levels of sergeant. For the officers, usually you come in as a second lieutenant, first lieutenant, captain, major, lieutenant colonel.
Or ensign. Or
ensign in the Navy. And then we have something called warrant officers as well, who usually are helicopter pilots or otherwise specialized occupations.
Okay. And it might help as far as providers go. You mentioned about the active duty, reserves, National Guard. How would that play into it? Like if you're caring for somebody who is in the National Guard or reservist, they're called up for active duty, and then they get off to active duty, how does that change? How would you coordinate care, for example?
Well, the first thing I'd do is I'd ask the person about their status, mm-hmm. and I would learn from that person, and it does get complicated at times. In general, you're either active duty or you're in the reserves, mm-hmm. but if you're activated in the reserves, then you're also on active duty okay. status. And in the reserves, there are actually 7 different types of reserves. The important distinction, I think, to know about is that if you're National Guard, you belong to a state. You're Louisiana National Guard or Maryland National Guard, and you've often trained together for many years, and you know each other, and you're going to be called up for local emergencies mm-hmm. like flooding and disasters. Well, if you're in the reserves, not a National Guard, you're part of a much larger catchment area. You may be traveling hundreds of miles to drill with your unit, and you don't quite have the same level of working together. But again, for the clinician out there, it's really important to ask the soldier, sailor, airman, marine about what their job is.
Okay, and if you're a reservist or National Guard, how often do you get together? How much camaraderie would you build, you think, in that time period?
Well, that's 2 different questions. How often do you get together really depends. It used to be it would be 2 weeks a year and mm-hmm. an occasional weekend, but now we've had such activation of the reserves that many of them have spent 15 months okay. Several times deployed into the theater. Wherever you are, there's going to be the attempt to build up camaraderie. What's tricky in some cases, though, is people sometimes are called what's called cross-leveled. Mm-hmm. So they may, if they're a particular skill that a unit needs, they may go to a unit that they've never worked with before because that unit needs their skills. And so the unit should be working to integrate them into the unit, but that can be kind of disruptive.
And this is really open to both of you, but why do you think it's important for a clinician, nurse, doctor, health provider, PA, practitioner, etc., to know about this background?
Well, I think because for them to know about and understand what the experience of the service member patient who's coming to them really helps them understand what their potential health considerations are. If a reservist comes to them who's currently on an inactive status, they still may be preparing for a deployment 6 months from now and will mm-hmm. be leaving again. So recognizing the fact that where they're at in terms of their military careers and the kinds of work that they do puts them at variable exposure to combat or to some of the consequences of combat.
And you mentioned earlier just the sheer number. There are actually more military family members than there are people serving. So knowing what a mom or a dad or a husband or a spouse, wife might be doing would be very important, I think, as well.
It is. And in addition, military service members are very proud of their service. Mm-hmm. And so it's a good conversational opener. What do you do? And it helps you understand the strengths of that person. Most military folks don't like asking for help. They don't like admitting weakness. And it's wise to build on their strengths. One other point, you mentioned exposure to combat. Of course, wars are often very environmentally dirty. And so they may well have been exposed to petroleum or sand. land or possibly chemical weapons or something else. And that becomes part of the total healthcare picture, which really all practitioners should be asking about exposure, chemical exposure.
So what does a provider do, for example, if you don't understand the acronym or the abbreviation? Because a lot of abbreviations are used in the military. How would you best handle that?
I think the best way is to ask the patient that you're working with. And there are some military culture 101 kinds of resources on the internet that are available for healthcare providers that they can access. But if they have a question, just ask. I think it is part of the military culture to use acronyms. So if they're dealing with a veteran or a service member or a family member, they may throw them out there. And I think it's important that the healthcare provider doesn't get flummoxed by that, that they feel comfortable sort of saying, I don't know what that is.
And that's perfectly acceptable.
And that's perfectly acceptable. And in fact, it probably will be appreciated that they have an understanding and an appreciation and want to learn about what it is that the family has done in the military.
Now, there's another point that I think it's important for our providers to know. They often confuse the military and the VA healthcare system, and they think we're all one. And we're not. There's lots of attempts to bridge the gaps, but we're different systems. So the military has a direct healthcare system. That's our military hospitals, places like Walter Reed, Brooke Army Medical Center, Tripler, Balboa in San Diego, Wolfort Hall. And then there's a purchase care system known as TRICARE, run by TRICARE Management Activity, TMA. And then the VA has a whole separate, very wide network of both hospitals and community-based clinics and walk-in centers called vet centers. And we're all talking to each other, but we're different systems.
When you're talking about families, sometimes, you know, the husband or wife may have a civilian job, and their children may be covered under that, so they can have private insurance as well as these other insurance and have multiple coverage at times.
That's absolutely right. And so when we think about, I mean, this is really the culture of the military health system that is available to the whole, to all of the members of the family and the service members. When they're active, when they're between activations, if they're Guard or Reserve, and then when they become veterans. But I think that the other important part of that we want the healthcare providers who are watching this to recognize is that there is a life cycle in for military service members. There are ways that people come on active duty. They may stay for varying periods of time. They may come on for different reasons, and they may wind up, people use terms like retirement from the military, and usually what retirement means is very, very clearly that you've spent at least your 20 years in and have formally retired, and once you've retired, you actually go on a reserve status in the military versus leaving the service, becoming a veteran without retirement that still gives you eligibility for veteran services. A retiree is considered a veteran, but also people who've served for 180 days have eligibility for veteran care.
So, Kim, how would you phrase it? Would you say, what was your job in the military? Is that a good way of phrasing it? Or would you?
Sure. Okay. Sure, absolutely. What was your job? Maybe why did you join? Mm-hmm. And often people have joined for educational reasons. Mm-hmm. That's the reason I'm in the Army. They paid for medical school. Mm-hmm. Notice I said I'm in the Army. I need to correct myself. Yeah. I retired 6 months ago. But
she's forgotten that.
Yeah, I still have that piece. So I came in on a program called the Health Profession Scholarship Program where the Army paid for medical school. And then I had such a good time that, 25 years later, I finally retired. But so asking what the job was, and then again, you may want to ask about exposures. I already mentioned chemical exposures, certainly exposures to things that produce head trauma, and there's a lot of things, bullets, accidents, IEDs, intermittent explosive devices, et cetera, and then, of course, exposures that may cause post-traumatic stress disorder.
I would add questions also, where did you go, and what did you do? And some of those are because the interesting part of a service member's very often we're asked to do jobs that may or may not be aligned with what your specific assignment
sure.
is. You may be called upon to do a variety of different things. So it's helpful for the healthcare provider to know that. The reason why it's important to ask about where did you go, for a service member, you hear about deployments and experiences and exposures. For families, you hear about their transitions over time. Mm-hmm. And you hear about how a family, their life in the military may have included multiple moves, you know, 10, 20 moves that resulted in great experiences or may have also included very challenging assignments for the family where there weren't as many services or there wasn't a great educational fit for the children or there were dislocations in terms of disruptions or interruptions in healthcare for conditions of family members that were more challenging.
So asking about that, what did your spouse, what do your parents do if you're seeing a family member or mm-hmm. could be very useful too?
Yeah, so one note of caution is sometimes the service member can't talk about specifics of a particular mission or operation. It's mm-hmm. classified, so you need to respect that.
Certainly.
But they'll usually say, I can't talk about it.
Okay. Well, Steve, why don't you talk just a little bit about why do volunteers enter the military service? You've talked a little bit about from Cam's perspective, it paid for medical school, actually. Mm-hmm. But what other reasons?
I think there are a lot of reasons that that people enter military service. There's a tremendous amount of patriotism in the country, and young people oftentimes enter the service because it's something that they want to do, or there are family transitions of traditions of military mm-hmm. service where many family kind of occupational traditions, the military is one of them. So they may join the same service as a parent or an uncle, or they may be in a different service, but that may be some of the reasons.
Okay, and you mentioned some of the benefits we've talked about, and then there's that life cycle that we talked about earlier that I guess people have to ask about and see how long were you serving, why did you serve, did you retire early, and so on.
Well, and there are also a lot of different checkpoints along the way for military career people. Mm-hmm. So whether we're talking about basic training, whether we're talking about officer training, advanced training, whether we're talking about other kinds of specialty training that military service members get, they're all important and I think very often cherished parts of their occupational experience.
Okay. Well, I know there's been a major change, at least for my generation, where we had the Vietnam War. This is an all-volunteer army, Cam. So how has that impacted?
It's an all-volunteer army, and as important, everybody who's in the army now knows they're going to war. Prior to 9/11, people might have thought, well, I'm going to join for the educational benefits, and I might deploy once or twice in my career. Now people know when they join that they are going to go to Iraq or Afghanistan or the Horn of Africa mm-hmm. or someplace else. And they're proud of that. Sometimes people think, well, you know, they should be able to stay home. Most of the people who are in the military enjoy deployment. Mm-hmm. They know they're going to do it. At the same time, deployment is clearly stressful, clearly dangerous. So there's both a feeling of being battle-hardened, but also a tiredness, a sense of fatigue. And then, again, for the reserves, they are deploying, too. They're no longer the army that stays at home. They're very much a part of the fighting force.
And Cam, National Guard or reserves are going to both deploy.
Yes, yes.
And, Cam, I would add also that as a result of understanding this shift in the deployment cycle, which used to be a deployment, you prepare, you go, you come back, now is a cycle and a routine and an expected part of military service that really can vary in terms of the level of intensity and the level of stress on service members and families. And there have been a lot of great programs that have been developed in the military that focus on readiness and developing prevention and resilience to keep people and families strong so that they can deal with the ongoing stress and pressures of repeated deployments.
Yeah, and the deployments compared to Vietnam, are they longer or not? What do you think?
Vietnam and Korea were both a year. Mm-hmm. World War I, World War II, you went, and when the war was over, you came back. So it's different from both, not just in the length of deployment, which is usually about a year for the Army, usually about 7 months for the Marines, but the fact that people are going over and back mm-hmm. again, and that we have internet communication and Skype, et cetera. So when you're over there, you're you're conscious of your family back home, which is a two-edged sword, because it can be great seeing the pictures of your new baby, but it can be very difficult hearing about family problems. And unfortunately, some of the suicides that we've had in theater are where people knew about their family problems, but felt kind of trapped. They couldn't get home to take care of them. So some of the work we've been trying to do around families and communication is sort of think before you push that send button.
Okay, in terms of emails or other kind of accounts as well.
Exactly.
But even in the communication, you think before you say things and how that works. And what about the mental health advisory teams and also the suicide rate you're talking about? Because I know there have been
We've had an incredible amount of studies done in theater and back here. We've had now 7 mental health advisory teams, which have looked at symptoms of depression and anxiety. The important thing about the mental health advisory teams is they've helped us improve our behavioral health delivery system in theater. Now, the suicide rate has definitely been troubling. It's gone up in all branches, especially high in the Army. It's finally flattening out now, but it's still going up in National Guard. So, again, for the providers, it's going to be very important to have them look for indications of suicidal ideation in the service members or their families.
Yeah, and this could be even veterans of the Vietnam War, Korean Wars, et cetera. Maybe it's in risk. So paying attention in general is a good idea for suicide risk with these conditions.
You know, I think another cultural issue that's really been a shift over the past 10 years is, and it's related to suicide, but it's also related to mental health conditions in general, is a desire to become much more open and to ensure the accessibility to care, mm-hmm. to actively address stigma, to talk about expected reactions and help service members and family members feel comfortable saying, you know, I've had these exposures, I'm having difficulty managing with post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, anxiety, substance use problems. That's been variably successful, although I think there's been a tremendous effort to try to encourage people to seek care. But another important shift in military culture.
That's happening, obviously, in the civilian population as well as the military. It's hard to get rid of the stigma. How can a clinician, Steve, handle that? What can they do in terms of how they approach a patient?
Well, I think first you want to be aware of the conditions, mm-hmm. the likely or the potential outcomes of combat exposure, especially whether we're talking about combat stress reactions, whether we're talking about depression, post-traumatic distress disorders. Know what those signs and symptoms are, and to be asking questions. There are great screening materials that are out there that primary care providers and other clinicians can be aware of and use those when they're asking veterans or service members about their experiences to see whether they're endorsing symptoms that would be consistent. And then to talk with them about the fact that these disorders are diagnosable and treatable. There are treatments for them, and because of that, if we treat early, it's much less likely we're going to develop secondary problems either in the individual or in the family.
And I think, again, we all know clinically it's an important thing to try to be, again, unbiased, not carrying your own prejudices or biases when you go in and see somebody. Whatever your beliefs are, you take them at face value and see them in a neutral way, but caring way.
Well, I think one of the great things that's happened over the last 10 years is whatever people have thought about the war and mm-hmm. wars, obviously they've been controversial, people have really wanted to take care of the service members. Mm-hmm. When I was in uniform and flew in the airport, for example, everybody would come up to me and say hello. And that's really important for the service members to continue to have that level of public recognition of them and their sacrifice.
And I think that's been a change that I've seen, quite honestly, over prior wars.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
And it's meant a lot to the military families and the service members.
I think it's important for healthcare providers who don't understand or don't have as much experience in the military to really to make sure that they bring no assumptions to the expectations of the families that they treat, either in any direction. Mm-hmm. I think the vast majority of military families, in my experience, are very proud of what they do. But we need to ensure that we approach them with respect and try to understand what their experience is. what the connections they have to the military, how it supports them. Are there challenges there in terms of their relationship to the military that are important for them to understand as healthcare providers?
Well, certainly the respect is an important thing that you want to do.
Another thing to know is that although we talk about post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, there's a whole range of reactions to having served. Mm-hmm. And some of them are mild, will go away on their own. Some of them are persistent and may need treatment. And to work with the service members about that, what I often say is, you know, if the symptoms go away in 3 months, probably don't need treatment, but if they persist and get in the way of your family relationships or your work relationship, then it's time to get a little help.
I think that's a great point. And, you know, at our center, we'll talk about PTSD as kind of ranging from like a sore throat to cancer in terms of its level of intensity. But, you know, if you have a strep throat and you don't treat it, you know, you could run into pretty significant problems.
And I think the other thing to remember is this can happen to family members, because a certain percentage of family members of somebody who's injured or comes back with a traumatic brain injury, things like that, may develop problems too and may need care. And the duration of treatment may vary for that person too, depending on their past history and vulnerabilities. And certainly we don't want to forget about the impact of alcohol and, as you mentioned, the suicides, drugs too. So looking at relationship stressors, Steve, what do you think? What can be done to improve things with that?
Well, first, I think all military families now have a better sense than when the war started about what it means to be in the military. And so that in and of itself, I think, has led to a greater understanding that they're going to be facing deployment stress and deployment challenges. More than anything else, I think it's extremely important that people seek out resources when they need them, that they're talking together as families, making family decisions, that if problems develop, whether it's a result of deployment or other challenges that they're facing in the family, that they have active ways of and successful ways of solving problems setting goals for themselves as families.
And the stigma doesn't just apply to medical care. A lot of time it's employment issues, and they're ashamed to say, I haven't got a job, or my dad doesn't have a job, or my mom doesn't have a job. So a community can help out as well, clearly, in those areas too. So we've talked some about some of the family challenges. Anything else, Steve, you think we need to cover and add to that?
Just remembering that deployment is not just about separations and reunions, but sometimes, as we've been talking about, service members can come back with illnesses. Mm-hmm. They can come back with injuries. Those injuries and illnesses can vary in terms of their intensity. And that families are we do need to remember that PTSD, traumatic brain injury, are conditions that affect the whole family, and that it's extremely helpful for healthcare providers to be talking with people or talking with service members and families about the conditions, so it builds a better understanding within the family as to what's happening and how they best can address it.
And just to summarize, the long deployments impact not just the service member, but also the family members and the children too. And from a child perspective, we clearly need pediatricians to be aware, primary care doctors to be aware and understand what their parents are going through, these children.
That's right, because we've seen and we've reported elevated distress in children, and that there are certain children that might be at greater risk because of pre-existing conditions, or possibly if a family or especially the stay-at-home spouse is having trouble.
And Kim, you mentioned early on about 15% of people in active duty now are female. Are there any gender differences in terms of what you're seeing?
Well, men and women in the military are more alike than they are different. Mm-hmm. For example, the rates of PTSD among men and women in the military are almost exactly the same. Mm-hmm. What women often have to struggle with, though, is issues around children and leaving the kids behind, or being the caretaker for parents and kids. In addition, one area that sometimes gets overlooked are issues around menstruation, about breastfeeding, about how do you manage gynecological issues in the field. Mm-hmm. And that's a challenge, although I think we've come a very long way in understanding it and talking about it, because if you don't talk about it, then you can't figure out the solutions.
But certainly if you're taking care of somebody who is, say, a reservist or even active duty, living in a rural area, just being aware of that or the female service member what she's going through may be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and also if there was any other exposures, if there were assault experiences mm-hmm. in theater that female service members may not have felt comfortable sharing with others, healthcare providers need to be prepared to be listening and asking about those questions.
And that's true for both men and women.
That's right.
Absolutely, yeah. And being single parents, things like that, we have not talked about, but if you are a single parent, that could be much more challenging as well, for certain.
Yes, it certainly can. The military tries to make sure that everybody has a plan, so if the parent is called up, that there's somebody else to take care of the child. Especially in the beginning days of the war, that was problematic at times. Now, again, deployment is so much of the part of life for soldiers that people are pretty good. They know they're going to get deployed, so what do you do with a kid?
Well, okay. we also need to remember that deployments, in fact, create single-parent families, and that there are certain vulnerabilities to single parenthood that's where really communities can be very mm-hmm. helpful, and healthcare providers can be helpful in terms of providing respite and support and assistance to, you know, a mom or a dad who's home while that other parent is
And deployed. It doesn't just last 3 months or 6 months. These needs may go on for a while. For sure.
Well, I think there's the immediate need around the deployment mm-hmm. and keeping a family functioning together, and then there's a very, very long-term impact of the war on health, which is going to be for decades.
Okay. Well, Kim, just to summarize a little bit for the key steps for community clinicians, what do you think they need to do?
I think, first of all, they need to ask anybody who comes in the door, if they're a service member, if they're a veteran. They should avoid prejudices or mm-hmm. stereotypes. They should they should know that the person is going to be proud of what they've done, and they should respect that. And then finally, soldiers, service members, Marines, they're not victims. They volunteered, they raised their right hand, they knew they were going into danger, and they're proud of what they've done, and they need to respect that.
And I would add the one thing that always, as a care provider, you may be engaging one individual in the family, but try to use a family lens in recognizing that these are family experiences where more difficult outcomes are likely to have a broader effect.
Right. And you often need to think about treating the family or getting involved with perhaps couple counseling or family therapy or things like that as well. And so in conclusion, I definitely want to thank both of you all for a great panel discussion, and to encourage you as an audience to learn more about caring for military families or to earn CME or continuing education credits in nursing, you can click on the links below, and we really appreciate your paying attention to this important topic today.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Military Culture, an introduction for community healthcare providers. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.